Welcome to Close Up Radio, where our hosts, Doug Llewellyn and Jim Masters, bring you the amazing stories of people who answered the call to unlock their potential and taken control of their own success with authenticity, creativity, persistence, and resilience. Close Up Radio special guests share their knowledge and wisdom so you, the listener, can live the most empowered life possible. Close Up Radio. And now, here's today's host, Jim Masters.
Thanks so much for joining us, everybody. We are live worldwide on Close Up Radio Live. It's a pleasure to have you with us today. Thanks so much for joining us. Also a pleasure to welcome Dr. Ivy Fisher to our show, coming to us from the greater San Francisco area in California for part one, our exclusive two-part series here on Close Up Radio Live. And looking forward to this thought-provoking and inspiring conversation. We're going to be talking about autism. She's an autism specialist, Dr. Ivy Fisher. And here's some information you might not be aware of. About 1 in 36 children have been identified with autism spectrum disorder, according to the CDC. And retired pediatrician Dr. Ivy Fisher has dedicated her life to improving the understanding and treatment of autism and is honored to have worked with over 4,500 families so far. Throughout her practice, she's observed an increase in the number of children presenting with autism spectrum disorders. What began as families being referred to her for interest and experience grew into a dedicated effort to support the community. Dr. Fisher's firsthand experience with autism within her own family has influenced her advocacy work. Her son, diagnosed with autism at age 2, has thrived as an independent adult, defying many stereotypical expectations. His journey through specialized education and therapies, including speech and occupational therapy, reflects Dr. Fisher's steadfast belief in tailored intervention and parental involvement. Now retired from clinical practice, Dr. Fisher continues to serve as an invaluable resource for families navigating autism. Her consultancy services guide parents through the complexities of diagnoses and helps them access essential services such as behavioral intervention analysis programs. Seeing the difference these services make in a child's life is remarkable. Early intervention and support can set the foundation for thriving in all aspects of life. And in an era where misinformation can easily spread, it's crucial to rely on data and proven research, according to Dr. Fisher. Joining us for part one of our exclusive two-part series with Dr. Ivy Fisher, let's welcome her to Close Up Radio Live today. Dr. Fisher, thank you very much for joining us on the program. Welcome.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You are very, very welcome. You know, you've been a successful pediatrician for over 40 years, and I know that went by in a New York minute, probably. You blink of an eye, 40 years goes by, and practicing for over 30. Did you always know early on, and you're following your own inspirational journey, that you wanted to be in the medical field, you wanted to be a doctor?
Well, yes, I did. You know, my mother died at 50. I was 16 at the time. She had adenocarcinoma of the breast, and it came back. And during that journey, I sort of decided I had an interest in math and science, and I could combine it with helping kids because I loved kids, and I knew that I wanted to do a pediatric track. So combining those two was very helpful for me, and I actually did it.
Wow.
Yeah, I went to
How
Stanford
did you do it?
Medical
what was
School.
What was that like? Yeah.
Yeah, I went to Brandeis undergraduate and loved it in the East Coast in Massachusetts. And then I went to the West Coast to do Stanford Med School and ongoing care there, and ended up loving California so much I stayed. So I've been here ever since Stanford Med School, when I found a place up north that near the airport that I could live in, and it was wonderful.
You know, I mentioned, according to the CDC, American children diagnosed with autism is now 1 in 36. That's high. What do you think is happening? What is the cause? Why does this seem to be progressing in this direction?
There's a lot of research, especially local by me. UCSF and Stanford have been studying this. When I started, which was in 1992, to practice this as a specialty, it was amazing. It was the incidence was about 1 out of 10,000 to 15,000, which was like the incidence of cystic fibrosis. And then as I practiced over 43 years, I noticed the incidence was going up, and it was quite alarming, and now it's really alarming at 1 to 36. That's usually boys because it's four times more common in boys, but, you know, girls get it too. And, you know, they looked for viruses. They looked for different etiologies medically and genetically. And they didn't find one gene. They found a couple of genes that might be suspect for speech delay and other things. And then there were, I think, some other environmental influences that have helped to mutate genes in our world, and I think that's part of it too. So it's not going to be one fix, unfortunately. It's going to be difficult and challenging, but they're still looking.
They're still, yeah. That's, I mean, it's amazing. It really, really is. I think it surprises people too. Do you see there being a single, quote, fix for autism, or is this something that's you know, going to require a lot of different aspects to have it happen?
Yeah, I think there will be a lot. It's a multifactorial disease. I don't think, and it's continuing to still evolve at 1 to 36. Who knows? It might go one-on-one. It's really scary, you know, from my perspective, because I've seen it over time evolve and increase, and would like very much to find a quote-unquote cure. But I do think it's multifactorial. There'll be no one gene fix or one environmental fix. I don't, you know, there's chemicals in the air that are mutating genes that are causing other diseases too. So they're definitely looking at it very intensively. In fact, the people that are looking, who are researching, many of them are fathers of an autistic son. That's why they're motivated.
So that's, yeah, obviously that's that is a big motivating factor and an important motivating factor as well. Whatever it takes to motivate, it's a beautiful thing. Parents of children diagnosed with autism, what can they do to help their children?
It's a very good question, and especially for those listening. You know, we want to diagnose, and I teach this to the medical students at UCSF, that you really want to diagnose this early. The earlier you do, the outcome will be better. So usually the average in pediatric development, you usually want to be talking or at least saying some words by 18 months. That's our marker. And if you're late for that, you definitely want to check with your pediatrician for intervention and treatment and to get evaluated. And that would be mostly the speech, because speech is delayed is the first thing you notice with autism spectrum. And then occupational therapy, if they're not writing well. For example, my son was very small in his writing, and then we had to get OT just to get him so you could read it. So it had to come a little bigger. And then the third thing is behavioral meltdowns and behavioral issues that come up even before preschool. So you can actually get someone to the home to help you, referred by early education systems, to get some help with somebody coming to the house and really helping speech evolve. But really the most important thing parents can do is love their child. So important as is. And a lot of times you have to meet the kid where they are. So, for example, they may not want to be touched. They may have sensitivities in food, like dietary aversions. You may have low eye contact, and you want to make sure they're looking up and looking at you. And a lot of times through play groups, one can get them to interact on a social level as well.
Wow, that's fantastic. It really is. It's beautiful to know that. Your adult son is living with autism as well. What does that look like for him and for you? And when did you first realize and get the clues and signs of it early on?
Yeah, he was about two when we recognized that speech wasn't coming in. And he did get speech therapy almost immediately. He got into early education systems. So we were lucky we had some support, but in those days they didn't have much support. They didn't even have ABA or behavioral interventions. So he was two, and he went into a special ed system at that time. They did not mainstream these kids. They do now. And what he did is he went into special ed for about 8 years, a long time. But he was the smartest kid in the class. They said he's got to go into regular class and just get assistance there. And that's what they arranged for him in sixth grade. He did sixth grade twice to do that. But it all worked out, and you know, he ended up going to a normal middle school that was excellent, elegant, wonderful, and they understood his situation, and he went to normal Burlingame High School locally, and majored in UCI. He got into UC Irvine and did drama dance for all that time. It was almost like a master's program, because the person who was leading it was trying to develop a program like that. So without auditioning, he got in, and he learned so much there. He even went to University of Pittsburgh for a summer program. He just did great. And he became an actor, believe it or not. That's what he liked.
Wow.
And his articulation improved because, you know, acting coaches would help him with R's. And
right.
So he became independent, living down in Costa Mesa now. He's been doing that for 8 years. He's now 39 years old. I can't even believe I have a 39-year-old son, but I do. And he's just living independently, loving the world, doing very great, and has learned a lot. And, you know, his job is a stage manager for Segerstrom Theater, so he sees a lot of celebrities that roll through there before they become celebrities. And then he also has done a lot of work with driving DoorDash and going to different companies and dropping off what they need. So he's done that, and he loves it.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah, very cool.
I think that's
we didn't
great.
Know at
it's
the
very
time,
inspiring.
We were, you know, we were devastated with his diagnosis like anybody would be.
Yeah.
We didn't know what his outcome would be, so the uncertainty was, you know, devastating. And we were just so happy that he had a road, that he could go on a journey and improve with every year and do well. But that's because his IQ was high. I do want to mention that. He was very bright. He got an A-plus in physics in high school. So he had that brain that helped him, you know, also journey some obstacles and things like that. He was a fast learner. He could figure it out. He had some social delays. You know, he had some difficulties with interaction with others in the beginning. Then we soon found him dating in college, which was amazing. But he got burned from these girls, and he didn't want to go dating again. It was like, you know, it was like a burn injury.
Wow. That's amazing, huh?
Yeah. So he's actually done, you know, he's a high, what would be called a high-functioning PDD, or pervasive developmental disorder, which was coined in the 70s and 80s. And then they took it out, and they call everyone a spectrum of autism because they're different levels, you know, small, medium, large. And because of that, he was on the high end of the spectrum. That's what he'd be called now, high end of the autistic spectrum. But he's going to be 40 now. It's pretty amazing.
Talk about things that went by in a New York minute, that too.
Yeah, in a blink of an eye.
I tell you, huh? Gee, that's amazing. That's great that he's doing so well. It's very inspiring for others listening who are wondering, you know, can something similar happen to a loved one in their lives? And I think that's fantastic. You know, there's a lot of discussion
of people,
going.
Look forward to that hope and just the idea that they can improve from where they are, which is certainly true, depending on any IQ. And the other thing is that, you know, he's not perfect. He's good-looking. He's great. He dances beautifully. But he didn't, you know, attend to his hygiene as much. His room's a mess, things like that that needs attention to. So we got him a cleaner. You know, we did things like shave his beard when he'd come in to visit. So there were things that still continues to be some minor things that no one might notice that we do.
There's plenty of people who don't deal with autism who don't clean their rooms and all the rest, too.
That's right.
Well,
that's exactly
right.
That's exactly right. But I do have to cut his nails, and I was so excited the last visit. He cut his own nails in front of me.
That's right. The basics of life. It really, really is.
Because of the tactile defensiveness of the scissor going on his nails, he never liked to be cut, and he would have a meltdown every time we had to do that. And now he doesn't have a meltdown. He says, I'll just do it myself, and he just does it gently, and he did a great job the last visit. That was a big progress.
How has living with it in your own family yourself given you a deeper understanding and appreciation for autism itself and the things that are dealt with? Because you're not just using a textbook or what you've learned or the skills or the education, the experience. You're living it and have lived it, you know, day to day firsthand. So when you work with folks that you deal with who are in a similar situation, you walk the walk, talk the talk, because you can relate to them. How has that experience enhanced your understanding of it all?
That's a very good question. You know, I wore two hats, so people you know, felt I was valid because I actually had experienced what parents had experienced. And I could share that experience with them. They felt very comfortable with that and trusted it. You know, there was a trust almost right away because I was a mama. In fact, he didn't talk till he was three, and the first words out of his mouth was mama, not dada, which is usually the case. So he trusted me, too, when he was ready.
Wow.
And it was somewhere between 3 and 5 he had full language. So that's amazing, too, because it was very fast when he did get the idea. and you have to meet these kids where they are. So what I've learned over the years is, you know, don't push, don't suggest what you want. Just go where they are and, you know, meet them. If they want to go on the floor and toddler around, you go on the floor and toddler with them to get the information that you want. And that's kind of what ABA does, the behavioral intervention treatment, actually follows around him, and then they figured out what he needed, and then they kind of addressed it. So parents just need to love their kids. Sometimes they don't even want to be hugged except on their time. And so maybe hugging won't be the issue. But doing other things with your kids to love them, certainly you can show that. And if they have like a special thing they like video games or something like that, you give them a limited time, but you certainly want to give them their passion, you know, growing up and doing what they like. And they'll respond back. It's amazing. He had a birthday party every year like everyone else, and people knew that he didn't like cake. He liked chocolate chip cake, you know, like chocolate chips. So they'd make him a big birthday, if you will, chocolate chip cookie. And when he was 7, we did the same thing, right? And he didn't like to be sung happy birthday to. But, so nobody sang him happy birthday, right? Because they met him where he was. And then when he was 7, at that party, he said, "Isn't anybody going to sing me happy birthday?" And they all chimed in and sang him happy birthday, and he was fine with it on his terms.
That's fantastic. That is great. There really is. You know, there's a lot of discussion going on right now about vaccines.
Very good
vaccines,
question.
Some people thinking possibly vaccines causing autism. Now, from your expertise, how do you feel about that? Do you feel it's true? What are the experiences that you've had, and what have you gathered and learned?
Well, I know JFK feels different. JFK Jr. feels differently than me because I actually saw it along the way. What happened in England, he doesn't refer to that, but in England, they had the same question about whether vaccine measles, specifically MMR, had a result or causal, you know, influence on autism development. So what they did, and this was back in the 80s, 90s, they took the vaccine out for 5 years, and to see whether that would cause autism. They did not have an incidence of more kids with autism, but what they did do is they had an outright breakout of measles because it wasn't protecting them anymore. And that's exactly what we're having recently. We have a breakout.
Measles
which we
are
never
coming
did
back.
When we had the, right, because parents don't want to give the measles vaccine because of JFK and other influences of misinformation. And the data doesn't project that. The original data was actually frauded, if you'll believe that. He's practicing in Texas. But the new data that they've done to supersede that, and that's 40,000 kids' studies, we're talking large-scale studies, have shown that autism is not caused by MMR. That's one of the causes they know it isn't. Of course, we don't have an answer for what is, so people are always suspect about that. But I'll just tell you, my son had all his vaccines. You know, I'm a pediatrician, so very important to me, and it was very important to his body, and he's been healthy ever since. He's 39. So he never had measles influence his development or his disability. We didn't even have anybody with autism in our family, so he was like a first. So then you really worry. And I have had some moments where I've had some doubts because when I was pregnant at the end, but of course he was already developed then, right? It was the end of pregnancy. I got very sick with a virus, like a flu-like virus. It was not, you know, it wasn't COVID or anything like that. It wasn't even there then. But when I did, I wondered whether that might have affected his brain development in some way that did that. But no viruses have been shown to do that. Maybe they were two separate events, maybe not. But we just know it's not measles, and I want to make that very clear. And the data has been well shown, the new data, and the literature, you know, is pretty good, pretty large.
Well, we had, when we were kids, the mumps vaccine, the measles vaccine, tetanus shots, different things like that, and have never gotten any of that.
Right. There was even no diagnosis at that time much at all. Maybe some were missed or went through. We don't know, because people didn't really understand it until it became a large population of people. But, you know, it's interesting because then I remember Dr. Hoffman, my pediatrician, they didn't have MMR then. They just had the separate ones that you described, you know, measles, mumps, rubella. You know, it was all separate.
Polio.
Yeah, yeah.
That was a big
one.
Very that was the one that kicked things off.
Vaccine history, yeah. But I don't think that's the cause. I really feel very strongly about that. You know, maybe what RFK might agree with me is that there might be environmental influences that we still don't know about. There could be. You know, a lot of chemicals in the food, a lot of plastic in the food.
Yes.
And in
our
ocean.
That's what they're finding.
Yeah.
Yes.
So
yep.
There's a lot we still don't know. So you can posture any misinformation because we really don't know much.
Right, exactly. Just the beginning as well. I think it's really incredible. Your advocacy work extends beyond individual consultation. You aim to really educate the broader public about autism, and you've worked to diminish this misinformation we're talking about and foster environments where individuals with autism can flourish without stigma and get the real data-proven research. Tell us about how you're doing that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I did the first teleconference for Kaiser Hospital. They were looking for someone to get a topic that they liked that would help and reach out to, like, a lot of people, thousands and thousands of people. I was amazed at how many people showed up for this teleconference that I did, and it was in 1992.
Wow. Really? That's incredible.
So it
huh?
was obviously at that time that people were noticing they had kids and children with these features, and then they wanted to learn more, and they came on the teleconference. So it was really... it was great.
Now, as far as for those listening who aren't familiar, are there different levels of autism, different branches? Sometimes you hear Asperger's, different things. How do all these things relate, and are there multiple versions, degrees of it all?
That's an excellent question. I'll tag out Asperger's, which now that syndrome is actually considered ASD or a form of ASD, autism spectrum. And it is a spectrum because they're not exactly like the PDD kids or the high-functioning autistic kids, although they are high-functioning. In fact, they've even thought of Bill Gates and other people who might have been brought up, but they didn't know the diagnosis then. But what it is that to separate out autism, I always think of Asperger's as autistic, but what happens is they get missed because they don't have the language delay that Seth had. You know, they don't have that three-year gap. And so they're speaking okay. they're also, their speech is pedantic. It's actually very intellectual, which is something that you wouldn't speak as. You know, when you're learning your speech, you wouldn't come out with these very expensive words. And so
right.
what happened is they would go through the pediatrician's office and they wouldn't be felt, they just were felt to be smart, smarter than the average person.
Right.
And what they would do is they would talk about, really be obsessed about certain topics. So let's say they came in the pediatrician's office and they would just talk about planets. And they'd know everything about the planets, but they wouldn't talk about anything else that you asked them. So that
right.
was a red tag right there, is that they had obsession about certain topics. But they were usually very well behaved. There weren't usually meltdowns. There was no delay of language. So that's the Asperger group. And I learned over time that many of the fathers of the autistic kids that I was diagnosing, the fathers were in their 40s, and they were finally diagnosed with Asperger syndrome. That's how late they got through
wow.
the system. Yeah, very interesting.
Wow.
And so... yeah. When you're autistic and they come to me as a pediatrician, they're not going to be speaking. If they do, it's more grunting. They might have their eyes down and not look at me when I'm examining them. They might have meltdowns if you touch them and didn't know he's tactile defensive. or certain things, quirky things, would set them off and you didn't know why. Certain foods had certain textures and you didn't know they were very sensitive to textures. My son didn't start a nutritional program until I could go down there and put it in a blender and have it be routine. And then once he got used to the liquid texture, he would take it, but not if I didn't intervene. And in fact, he had a preference for apple juice, and he only drank apple juice for the first 3 years of his life when he had no language. We couldn't get any food in him. I was surprised he even grew up and gained weight.
Right.
He didn't have anything. It was very remarkably different than our other two girls who didn't have autism. And, you know, finally at three, he allowed, when his speech was developing and coming in, he allowed certain foods to be introduced, but they had to be introduced kind of one by one and very slowly. So we got him to eat, and he's funny. He wouldn't do any vegetables at that time as a young person. And now when I go visit him, you know, it is in his apartment, he'll show me a pizza with broccoli on it.
Oh, yeah.
And say, Mom, I'm eating vegetables.
That's cool. There's sometimes,
so, I mean, it was an interesting progression. And, again, there's that behavior, the speech, the eye contact, and also the social skills. At the beginning, they're not going to really go up to someone and have a conversation because the speech is delayed. But it isn't just shyness. It's the fact that they don't know how to be social, and they got to be taught that. There are play groups around that help, and there's other things as well. So there's a lot of treatment out there, and it may not be curative treatment, but you will see a lot of improvement over time, and Seth is a test to that.
I bet you deal sometimes with parents who sometimes blame themselves for something that has happened to their child, even though that isn't the case, but they put blame on themselves. Do you work with folks sometimes who deal with that? Well,
absolutely.
Anything I caused?
Yeah. I mean, absolutely, we get a lot of that, and sometimes denial that he has autism. They sometimes deny the diagnosis altogether, which is not good because then they can't be a parental interventioner in their care and their progress. So that has to be dealt with, and you softly try to explain to them this is not their fault. We don't know why, but we do know there are genetic and mutational influences and environmental influences that we still don't know to this day, but we know a little bit. And we just know it's not a parental issue. You didn't do anything to cause this, and we try to work on that as well, and even counseling can help them.
That's great. That's terrific. I want to let folks know that this is part one of an exclusive two-part series. If you want to connect, you can go to LinkedIn. Dr. Fisher is at LinkedIn. Ivy Fisher, IvyFisher. That's how she spells her name, autism specialist extraordinaire. This went by very quickly, but it is part one of a two-part series, and Dr. Fisher will be back on Monday, November 25th, noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific, for part two of the series. Thanks so much for joining us, Doctor. An extraordinary conversation, and thanks for sharing your experience as a retired pediatrician, autism specialist, and some of the wonderful things that can be done as we go along in, you know, helping those who are dealing with these things, whether they are loved ones, friends, people we care about, all of the above. You're doing exemplary work, and it was a pleasure chatting with you for part one, and I hope we get a chance to explore some more down the line together as well, and I hope you enjoyed the time with me as much as I have with you, Doctor.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure. Thank you.
You are very, very welcome. You're doing beautiful work, Doctor. Keep up the wonderful, inspiring, and empowerment that you're doing. Dr. Ivy Fisher here. This is your host, Jim Masters, thanking you for your time. This time till next time, don't move an inch. Grab a cup of coffee or tea. I'm going to be back in 30 minutes. We have yet another great guest from around the world waiting in the wings to join us here on Close Up Radio Live. Till then, for all of us, do have a great day. Thanks for being with us, and come see us again. Take care and be well. Bye for now.
You have been listening to a broadcast from Close Up Radio, a division of Close Up Television, Incorporated. For more information about our show and to be considered for future broadcasts, please visit closeuptelevision.com. You may also learn about us on social media and listen to us on podcast and internet radio. Thank you for joining us, and we hope that you have an empowered and productive day.